Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. If you haven't heard, Mayor Eric Adams yesterday officially raised New York City's COVID threat level from medium to high alert. That's the official term, high alert. The number of new cases has been rising again ever since the end of March, so have hospitalizations and deaths. According to the New York Times COVID tracker, 29 people in New York State died of COVID-19 yesterday. That's up from single digits per day in late March. Back in January, though, at the peak of the first Omicron wave, more than 200 people a day were dying in New York State. So 29 is not bad compared to that, but that's 29 people a day. Multiply that out by every day, and you know how bad that is. The hospitalization numbers follow a similar pattern. In January, peak of Omicron 1, around 13,000 New Yorkers were hospitalized with COVID at any one time. That fell all the way down to around 1,000 in March. Now it's approaching 3,000. The hospitalized and the dying continue to be disproportionately unvaccinated, too. According to the New York City Health Department, the high alert status means people should wear high-quality masks in public settings, both indoors and outdoors, they say. But the city did not return to an indoor mask mandate for restaurants or schools or anything else, nor to a vaccine mandate for indoor adult venues like restaurants and gyms if they didn't have them a week ago. In fact, despite knowing this was coming, Mayor Adams' one vaccine requirement change in the last week was to remove the vaccine mandate for New York City high school proms. The high alert status also comes with a city government advisory that people should consider avoiding crowded indoor events, but they put no new limits on such gatherings, leaving it to individuals and institutions, and no new protections for workers. The mayor did announce more distribution of masks at public schools and other venues and more distribution of free tests. So now we'll ask, who does this way of approaching a high alert period protect? And who does it leave vulnerable? We know that your immune status affects how risky this is for you, and so does your socioeconomic status. Essential workers who can't work from home offices, for example, are disproportionately lower income and people of color. That's who tend to have to work in the crowded indoor spaces that the city advises other people to avoid voluntarily. There's no more pandemic unemployment insurance either to help such workers take the city's advice to remain safe without going broke. Same goes for those who live in crowded or multi-generational households out of economic necessity. With me now, with all that as a starting point, Dr. Uche Blackstock, emergency medicine physician and founder and CEO of the group Advancing Health Equity, which helps equip healthcare organizations and startups with the tools and strategies to provide equitable care. Dr. Blackstock, always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be back to speaking with you.
And first, how do you see the overall curve of this latest Omicron wave? As I laid out, we're not nearly at the numbers of January, but we're going in the wrong direction. Are we headed back to a January level spike?
You know, Brian, I would say that it's, you know, we don't have a good sense of the true state of the pandemic, right? We have a lot of different misleading factors. For example, the fact that the community levels are based mostly on hospitalization and hospital capacity, the fact that there's no infrastructure for reporting at-home results. So I think that we are, one, severely underestimating the number of COVID cases that are out there. I mean, some people have been saying it could be by 5 or 10 times as high as what we do know the cases to be. And we do have a more contagious variant. And so while Omicron has this narrative that it's milder, we know by now that because it's more contagious, especially the B2 subvariants, it'll end up infecting a larger volume of people, increasing the risk for people to be hospitalized and then die. So
right.
Let me
follow up on mm-hmm. what you just said about probably underestimating the real toll that it's taking. You know, I didn't even give a cases number in my intro because of what you said. There are so many at-home mm-hmm. tests right now that don't get reported to authorities that the number of cases would surely be much less than are being reported. But hospitalizations and deaths, they can't be too misleading, or can they?
Well, no, I mean, they're misleading in the fact that, one, you know, there's always lagging indicators, right? So we know for people, often it'd be 2 to 3 weeks after they're infected for rates to go up. And then for deaths, it's a lagging indicator. It could be sure. 6 to 8 weeks for right. deaths to increase. And so I think we kind of have a mixed picture right now. It's sort of, we're at that point we've been at many times during the pandemic where we're like, okay, we see an increase in cases. We're seeing a slight uptick in hospitalizations. And deaths are either stable or declining, but that could be from, you know, because, you know, again, deaths being the lagging indicator. So, you know, I would say that, you know, hopefully we won't get to where we've been before, but it's still unclear. We still don't know because, you know, we still have many people who have not been fully vaccinated. A fraction of those have been boosted. So I think that there's also a lot of variation according to region as well. You know, we know the Northeast is highly vaccinated, but the Southeast is not. So I think only time will tell. And I hate almost saying that because the fact is that we've lifted all precautions. And so it's almost like watching a train wreck in a way and not being able to do anything about it.
And I did see in that New York Times COVID tracker that kind of, as you just indicate, the number of deaths per day nationally is less than it was 2 weeks ago. But in New York, the curve for week after week has been steadily up since March. From a health equity standpoint, who's most vulnerable or most likely to die or be hospitalized in the current wave?
Right. And just like in the intro, Brian, you know, you mentioned people, you know, obviously people who are immunocompromised, people who are elderly, and then, you know, obviously, you know, mostly low wage workers. Like we've actually seen, we have data that throughout the pandemic, low-wage workers are disproportionately infected because they're not able to be at home or work from home, one. But two, we still don't have workplace standards, you know, regarding COVID. So I would hopefully expect by now that we would have some sort of standards around indoor ventilation, air ventilation and filtration. I mean, how can you even politicize that, right? Ventilation, how could you politicize that? But we don't really have any workplace standards. So I really would say that those three groups, people who are immunocompromised, people who are elderly, and low-wage workers are the groups we really need to be concerned about because either their, you know, immune systems cannot protect them even if they are boosted. We're, you know, we are seeing even, you know, an increase in deaths among people who are vaccinated. And I know that that doesn't say that vaccines don't work, right? But that just because now we have more people who are vaccinated. But the fact is that so many more people are getting infected that we're seeing an increase in deaths. So I do think that those are the three groups we need to worry about. And unfortunately, this shift, you know, led by the Biden administration from, you know, collective response to shifting more onto the individual. You know, I know that I and my sister actually wrote an op-ed with one of her colleagues in the Washington Post recently about this. But this idea that, you know, it's up to the individual to keep themselves safe puts an unfair burden on those groups, on immunocompromised, on elderly, on low-wage workers, especially when there is still unequal access to the quote-unquote tools. So everyone doesn't have access to Paxlovid. Everyone doesn't have access to testing either right now. We know that a large number of mass vaccine testing sites have closed over the last few months. So, you know, if you don't have equal access to the tools, then it's really unfair to lift all the precautions like we have.
Can you go further into that? Who doesn't have access to Paxlovid if they get diagnosed with COVID and they're in a risk
right.
group where that would be prescribed?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I think even the Biden administration has admitted that their test to treat program has not been the success that that it was supposed to be. You know, even Dr. Ashish Jha, he mentioned actually earlier this morning in a Twitter thread that they're going to be talking about some new initiatives to increase access, but you need to have access to a health, you need access to testing. And we've actually already seen in terms of testing, so I mentioned testing sites are closing, but there actually are racial inequities on who is rapid testing or who is utilizing rapid testing. So that tells me that yes, even though people can maybe able to go to a website and order them, are we missing something around communicating to people the importance of these rapid tests, how to use them? And then also there's a digital divide. So people may not have access to log onto a website to order tests. So that's also, one issue that I think we really haven't thought about. And then you need access to a healthcare provider. And we know that there are, there's just disproportionate access, to healthcare based on certain communities, people of color, low income communities, and you need access to a healthcare provider to write a prescription for Paxlovid. So there are these like multiple steps that you need, testing, access to provider to get the Paxlovid. And I think there's some cities like New York City, which seems to be doing actually a great job in terms of decreasing the barriers to access the Paxlovid. But that is not universal. And definitely, I don't think that's the standard across the country.
So we see cases and hospitalizations and deaths going one way. We see policy going the other way. And we see the disparities in who's vulnerable to the worst outcomes. Are there elements of the policy response by the city, to get even more specific about this, that you're okay with and elements that you're critical of right now?
So this is the thing, Brian. I feel like I have to say this. I feel like once precautions were lifted, so once mask mandates were lifted, once vaccine requirements were lifted, it's really difficult just in terms of like human psychology to go back and say, hey, we're reinstating these policies, especially without clear messaging. I think the messaging should have been, so things are better now. So for now, we are going to consider lifting mask policies, given this is the current transmission level, or this is the current hospitalization rate, but we are going to reinstate it based on such and such criteria. So that wasn't done. And so I think now, because especially mask policies and vaccine policies have been lifted, really the horse is out of the barn. There's no going back, I think, for political reasons, I think for obviously economic reasons. And I think that has done a disservice to how this pandemic has been managed. And I do think that, this idea of getting things back to normal, first of all, things will never be normal, the normal that we knew. That I think we need to accept that. But what we need to really think about is, how do we function in a way, knowing that we are going to be living with COVID, to minimize infections, to minimize hospitalization, death, and essentially human suffering? And yes, people want to go out and have a good time, but I think there are ways that we can still consider doing that, but having some of these policies still in place.
Listeners, your call is welcome for Dr. Uche Blackstock on New York City and COVID high alert officially as of yesterday, but with no new rules on the medicine of it or the policy of it or anything related. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. I read the interview with you in Education Week in March.
Oh, yes.
In which you said it's unconscionable, you used that word, to leave protection to individuals rather than pursuing a collective public health approach. Public health is about public health. And that was in Education Week, and you talked about your own kids. So what would you be doing now or recommending if you were the health commissioner with respect to schools?
Brian, I would say that we would definitely have to have clear criteria that's communicated to the public about when we would reinstate mask rules. I hate using mandates because people hear mandates and they, I think it's scary. So reinstate mask policies above, a certain level, and when we would lift them. I do think right now, if the city is at a high level, which means that, there's a high level of transmission and that there's increasing hospitalization, that the recommendation is that, in public indoor places, you should be wearing a mask. So it is confusing to me, and actually I would just say it doesn't make sense to me that we are not reinstating masks in schools at this point.
And by way of a little recent history, just to remind people, because things are so compressed and so dense in our world today that we can forget what happened just a few months ago. When Omicron was on the way in December of last year, it's just a few months ago, Mayor de Blasio ramped up his so-called key to the city policy, which required vaccines for basically anybody working in person in the city, including in the private sector. That also required vaccination for school children taking part in extracurricular activities considered high risk, though not to simply attend school. Mayor Adams has rolled back the vaccine requirement for patrons of indoor businesses, but kept it in place for workers, except for performers and professional athletes. The mask mandate for kids over five in schools was lifted too. So this is a kind of, you know, head-spinning roller coaster, all these details coming and going, right?
Yeah. Oh, Brian, it's super confusing. What I will say is, yeah, I think, you know, we are at a different stage in the pandemic for a number of reasons. So, you know, more contagious variant. And actually, Brian, I got COVID a few weeks ago after you know, going 2+ years trying to dodge it. And actually, we got it because while we went traveling, and while we were abroad, they lifted the mask mandate for planes. And so while we were masked, the majority of people on our flight were not. And so
you think you got it on the plane? You think you got COVID on the plane?
I think one of my children got COVID on the plane. And then because the way that I timed it, it was the day that we traveled. And then he ended up infecting a few other family members, including me. And so I have to say that, if I had known that the travel mask mandate was going to be lifted while we were traveling, I probably would not have made that trip. But it was lifted so suddenly, like there was no notice or anything. And when we got to the airport, no one was wearing a mask. No one was wearing a mask on the flight. So it was almost inevitable.
We're going to take a short break. We'll continue with Dr. Blackstock in a minute. I definitely want to ask you what you think about the fourth dose or second boosters for different people. We have a lot of calls coming in, so a lot more to talk about regarding New York City now officially in COVID high alert status and other related things. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we talk with Dr. Uche Blackstock, emergency medicine physician and founder and CEO of the group Advancing Health Equity, on this day after Mayor Adams declared high alert status for COVID-19, spreading as quickly as it is now, hospitalizations and deaths going up as they are in New York City. And let's take a phone call. Here's Kylie in Northern Virginia. You're on WNYC. Hi, Kylie.
Good morning. How are you both doing?
Doing all right.
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you. So I have one really, hopefully, an easy question. So when we say vaccinated these days, what do we mean, right? Does that mean that you've been boosted, like, in the proper time? So just kind of what does it mean that somebody is, quote unquote, vaccinated these days? And then the second question on this whole issue of equity, I can't wrap my mind around why the government hasn't re-implemented COVID FMLA. And the reason, so this comes out of like a two-pronged approach. So number one, with the return to work, and I've actually discussed this with my employer.
And that's just so people know the initials, FMLA, Family and Medical Leave Act?
Yes, thank you. Because if we're doing a return to work and there's no coverage for me as an employee, if I get COVID or if I'm exposed to COVID and therefore I have to quarantine, if I have to use my PTO, this is very privileged, I acknowledge that, but if I have to use my PTO to cover that, then that becomes a problem. But then the flip side is, for people who don't have childcare, who don't have the luxury of having a pay cut if they can't go to work, then knowing your status, knowing whether or not you have COVID, really means very little if there's nothing you could do about it either way. So to me, the solution to that is to re-implement COVID FMLA, so that if you have COVID or if your kid has COVID or your aging parent has COVID, you can stay home, therefore not spreading it. So those are my two questions, comments.
Thank you, Dr. Blackstock. And I can just hear the heads nodding out there. Me too, me too.
Right. So first, I would for vaccinated means that you've had your two doses of mRNA vaccine, and boosted means that you've had at least one booster, one third dose of that vaccine. So that's what that means. And then in terms of the COVID FMLA, the comment that the caller made, obviously I totally agree with this. The fact is that the United States does not have the social safety net, have the workplace protections needed to really help keep people healthy, right? So when we talked earlier about, you know, low wage workers, many of them work in jobs with no paid sick leave. So even if they have a mild illness, if they're out for, you know, 7 to 11 days, that 7 to 11 days of pay that they are that they're losing. And so I've always said that, you know, this pandemic, there's no stronger argument in this pandemic for single payer universal health care, for you know, paid sick leave, paid family leave. You know, all of that is just so incredibly important that those are you know, items that other countries provide for their patients, other high income countries. And the United States continues to be an outlier in terms of not protecting workers and families.
Yeah, a friend of mine was just telling me about her sister who's staying home all this week with her COVID positive kids, using PTO, paid time off, vacation days, using their vacation days to stay home with her COVID positive kids. Isn't this government provision for that?
Right. And Brian, I just wanted to say, like, a lot of times, you know, people are, they compare the U.S. to European countries, but European countries have socialized medicine, right? They have these other provisions that keep society safe and healthy. And so we are, you know, so the fact that we have a certain number of hospitalizations here and deaths here and cases is very different than what's happening in Europe because of that safety net.
Let's go further into what the federal government is or isn't doing. They are stuck in gridlock over new funding to fight the pandemic. Congress stuck in gridlock over that. The Republicans won't support it. The Democrats want it. Does this mean, though, in practice, that tests and treatments and vaccines will be any less available or cost anything to lower-income people if they're currently free?
So Brian, I think ultimately what's going to depend on is what's happening on a local and state level. I think certain states, probably the ones that are more progressive, are going to be able to provide testing and vaccines and therapeutics to people who are uninsured at no cost. For people who are insured, they may end up actually having a cost. So even though their insurance company may end up paying for the vaccines and therapeutics and testing, their premiums may end up increasing in the long run because of that, without congressional funding.
And I did see the government is making a third round of tests by mail available for free. Anyone can sign up online to get 8 more at-home test kits mailed to us. So not everybody's going to know about that. Not everybody's going to have the wherewithal or the internet access, as you were saying before, but I still thought it was worth saying that out loud because a lot of people don't know. Third round of tests by mail available for free from the federal government.
Yes, and Brian, I have to say, I was shocked because I actually saw an article, actually from NPR. I saw an NPR article that announced it, I think, about 2 days ago. And I said, why wasn't there an announcement by the government? Why wasn't there a briefing saying, everyone, you are eligible for a third round of tests. And now this time we're increasing it from 4 tests to 8 tests per household. I mean, the communication is absolutely horrible. And I do feel like, I mean, at the very minimum, they should be offering these rapid tests to households, at the very minimum, considering, you know, our current situation.
Yes. And by the way, the website for that is covidtests.gov, covidtests.gov, hopefully easy enough to remember. Vanessa in Bayside, you're on WNYC with Dr. Uche Blackstock. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi. Oh, my gosh. I'm totally fangirling right now. I listen to your show every day. I'm so glad to be on.
Glad you're on.
I just wanted to ask the doctor if her child was masked on the plane, her child that contracted COVID, she believes, was on the plane, or if the child was under 2 years old, because my husband and I will be flying for a wedding, and while our 6-month-old will be staying here, We're obviously going to mask on a plane, but we're nervous about the travel and coming back and possibly bringing something to the baby.
So, yes, my children are both over 5 and they were both masked on the plane. So one thing about planes for people to understand is that, you know, being on the plane itself is actually relatively safer than the boarding process and deplaning when the air circulation is turned off at those time points. And so often what I recommend for people, if you're on the plane, to direct there's the air vent above the seats, direct it towards your face. That's one recommendation. But the challenge obviously is with deplaning and boarding where people are just, you know, in the jetway, you know, indoor space, crowded right next to each other. That's where the risk happens, unfortunately.
Vanessa, be safe on that trip. Good luck. Call us again. If your kids were masked on the plane and you think they got COVID on the plane anyway, what do you say to listeners who might hear that and throw up their hands and say, well, then masking doesn't matter. I'm not going to mask.
Oh, well, no. I mean, we know that really universal masking is most effective, right? When everyone is masking, that's when we really have decrease in transmission. But one-way masking is effective. It's just less effective. I think people have to think about, you know, these multi-layered strategies, and you should still mask. It still is protective to some degree, but it's not as protective as if everyone else is masking. So just for people to know, like, my children still wear a mask to school. They never stopped wearing a mask to school. And that's just because of me. I'm sorry, go ahead, Brian.
Oh, I was just curious what percentage of your kids' class, since it's voluntary now, I gather, are masking.
Yes. Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I drop off, I always look, and I would say probably definitely the majority of children in the classroom are masked, probably about 60% are masked. And they go to a very diverse school racially, socioeconomically. It's a New York City public school, obviously, but it's a very diverse class. And I was surprised, actually, that the masking rate wasn't higher. I was surprised it wasn't close to 100, but it was definitely the majority of kids were masked.
Interesting. And you said in that Education Week interview that you thought lower income kids of color in New York were choosing the remote option when that was available, or really their parents in most cases were choosing it for them, choosing the remote option at a higher rate than other kids because they didn't trust the school system to actually be acting in their interest. Do you think we've learned anything after that phase?
I mean, Brian, I would hope so, but we seem to be making the same mistakes. Like, I honestly think that there was really an opportunity for, the DOE really to meet parents where they were and to really acknowledge the concerns that they have. I always talk about this idea of institutional mistrust, that it's really not people who mistrust the institutions, but the institutions have proven themselves untrustworthy for a very long time. And so there are different things that you can do with the community to engage them. And so I always talk about our school principal, who held numerous town halls to answer parents' questions, gave very detailed descriptions of how the classrooms would be set up and, you know, air purifiers, windows opening. Anyway, just a lot of details to make us feel more reassured about bringing our children back into the classroom. And I know that wasn't done at other schools, but that should be really the standard.
And staying on the topic of schools, Erica in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC with Dr. Uche Blackstock. Hello, Erica.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I am calling you from quarantine. I've been home since last Monday when my daughter tested positive for COVID. Turns out about half her sixth grade class had it. Wow. Not so surprising given the mask situation. She fortunately tested negative and was able to return to school on Monday of this week, but I remain stubbornly positive. And fortunately, I can work from home, so don't have much to complain about there, except for the fact that I had to rely on very generous friends and whatnot to kind of navigate getting her to school while I'm stuck at home because I am a single parent. So my comment is, like, just to reiterate what others have said, I think it's ridiculous for us to be putting kind of the onus on young kids to make these decisions around masks in schools when this is so obviously a high risk situation for everybody now. So kind of just share that frustration and kind of the absurd situation that we're in. I actually had also a question about the recent thing about boosters for kids. My daughter is 11 and she got vaccinated earlier this year. I was really surprised when those vaccines, when the emergency approval came out, because it was the same dose for kids between the ages of 5 and 11. And as any parent of a young kid knows, most medications for kids kind of change based on their weight. So the fact that they have not shown to be as protective doesn't really surprise me much, because my daughter is twice as big as a 5-year-old. So she's turning 12 in the fall. So I'm thinking it just makes sense to wait till she's 12 and to get her kind of a quote unquote adult dose at that point, especially now that she's had COVID. Yeah, as a booster, because that would be, the dose is 3 times as much. And I feel like we have some protection in the meantime because of this recent infection. So I'm just curious about the doctor's thoughts on that as a strategy. Yeah,
great questions, Erica. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, that's an interesting question. So, of course, you know what I'm going to say. I'm going to say I would not wait to get the booster. And one of the reasons, actually, is because we're seeing with the Omicron variant and the subvariants that you really don't develop that much immunity from infection, and that we're seeing multiple reinfections, like within a year, during a year, rather. So it is possible that between now and when your daughter's birthday, that she would actually get another COVID infection. And of course, we know that increases the risk of COVID complications, of long COVID, of multi-system inflammatory syndrome. And so that's why I would recommend that your daughter gets the booster as scheduled 5 months after her second dose.
So a couple of follow-ups there. One is, are there a lot of people who had Omicron in the winter now getting Omicron BA2?
Oh, yeah. We're seeing, actually, Apoorva Mandavelli, who's been on your show, at the New York Times science writer, she just actually wrote a piece about this, about people, you know, within a few months getting reinfected again with Omicron, especially with the Omicron variant and subvariants. We're seeing an increase in reinfection because the immunity that you're developing from the Omicron variants is very different from the wild type variant. So you may have some immunity for 1 or 2 months, but you're likely to probably get another infection again if you're exposed.
And another news story from the last day that hooks to Erica's call, the FDA yesterday approved first boosters for kids 5 to 11 years old. The CDC also has to approve it for them to actually become available, but that's expected. Do you recommend boosters for all 5 to 11-year-olds who got the original vaccine?
Oh yes, definitely, Brian. And what I'll say is that, you know, right now, only about 30% of 5 to 11-year-olds are fully vaccinated. So I think we need to really do a push in terms of public health messaging and, you know, talking to pediatricians, to increase those numbers. My kids are going to be getting their boosters next week, actually. One is 5 and one is 7 years old. And so I also just wanted to make a comment about the caller mentioned the difference between the 5 to 11 dose and the 12 and up dose. So the 5 to 11 dose is a third the adult dose. And it's not based on weight. That's not how vaccines are, how they're dosed. That's different from other therapeutics. But the thought is that maybe because this dose is a third of that of the adult, maybe that is why it hasn't been as effective in kids. But that's why they're recommending this third booster, which is another dose of a third of the adult dose. I'm sorry, that's confusing. But basically, 5 to 11-year-olds will be getting 3 doses that are the same.
Some tweets coming in. Listener writes, in Nassau County, maybe 5% of elementary school children wearing masks at my daughter's school. Another one, my 4-year-old has to get tested every time she has cold symptoms due to her school policy. Tests must be performed by doctors. The tests are no longer free, is my understanding, writes that individual. To that one, is there someplace where anybody can get a free test if they know where to look?
So a free rapid test or PCR?
PCR.
Oh, I think NYC Healthy, so Health in Hospitals and the New York City Department of Health, you can still be tested at any of their sites for free. So everyone should know that, that's listening.
And another tweet, listener asks, are there New York City legal protections for workers with comorbidities that make them more vulnerable to serious illness from COVID if they return to a group office setting with no mask mandate, social distancing, or improved air filtering?
Actually, legal Brian, protections. I'm not sure, Brian. That is not within my scope of expertise, but I wonder, have you spoken to
guests? I don't really know the answer to that either. I imagine the Americans with Disabilities Act might kick in at some point. But obviously that act was not conceived with COVID in mind, and I don't know if there have been legal gray areas identified with that. So listener who posts as vaccinated, masked, socially distant, that's their Twitter handle, we'll follow up on that and try to get you an answer, but it's not going to be in today's segment. Let's end with a second booster question that a lot of people have been asking when they call in recent days, and that is, do you have an opinion about, for people who are going to get the second booster, switching brands for a broader spectrum of protection? Or some people say the Moderna has just proved itself to be better than the Pfizer over time.
Well, so Brian, there's no hard data looking at the fourth booster and mixing and matching with the fourth booster, but I think that people should feel free to get whichever booster, either Moderna or Pfizer. I would say, yeah, Moderna has seemed to have performed a little bit better, I think because the dosage is higher compared to Pfizer. But I think you can't go wrong either way. And I would just love as many of people, if they're eligible, to get boosted.
Wait, the dosage is not higher relative to Pfizer, right? Isn't the Pfizer the like 100 micrograms and the... I see. It's 50 micrograms compared to 30. So you're right. The Moderna, even at what they call a half Moderna dose, is still more micrograms.
Right.
Than
so that's what.
Are you just recommending Moderna?
No. I'm saying you can't go wrong either way. But if it makes someone feel better to get Moderna, then that's fine. But either choice is fine. Moderna or Pfizer.
Dr. Uche Blackstock, emergency medicine physician and founder and CEO of the group Advancing Health Equity. Thank you as always. So informative as always. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's always an honor to be in conversation with you.